I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. President Obama has been in high gear touting the Iran nuclear accord to the American people and to Congress. While Republicans oppose it, he does have support in the Democratic Party, but not from Senator Chuck Schumer, who announced that he was voting against it. Our guest, Jonathan Landay, has been covering the story for McClatchy, where he is national security and intelligence reporter. And Jonathan Landay, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here.
You wrote that the Obama administration is pretty confident that this Iran nuclear deal will go ahead, but it sounds like they have a couple of hurdles to go through first. What are some of those hurdles?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that you're going to see the Republican-controlled Senate and the House pass what's being called a resolution of disapproval in the nuclear deal. And this resolution is aimed at effectively killing the deal by preventing the United States from doing its part under the deal and lifting sanctions against Iran. The president has vowed that he will veto such a resolution. And right now, what they're doing is trying to, what the White House is doing is trying to shore up what it believes is enough votes in the House of Representatives, and it looks like perhaps the Senate, and you only need one House, to effectively block an override of his veto. And right now, it looks like in the House, he's got a comfortable margin.
And we're talking some math here. As you calculated, Jonathan, about 146, at least as of what, today, 146 people in the House that support this?
No, you need the president needs 146 votes to prevent a override of his veto in the House. And right now it looks like he's got about 152 and counting. There was a letter that was put together by 150 Democrats in May supporting the negotiations that were going on at that point for the Iran deal. And I called one of the organizers of this letter last week to ask whether or not that number was holding. This is Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky of Illinois, and she told me that not only is that 150 number holding, but they've now got at least two more. That would be Representative Schiff of California, the ranking member on the House Intelligence Committee, and then Sander Levin, who is the most senior Jewish member of the House of Representatives. That's 152. And she said that there are others who are going to embrace the deal but are not ready to go public.
And what do you think the effect of Senator Chuck Schumer announcing that he opposes this deal? I don't know if that was a surprise or not, but do you think that will give other members of the Democratic Party some cover or some reason to oppose this deal?
I think that more than anything else, you know, Senator Schumer was never expected to embrace this deal. He was always expected to oppose it. The only question was the timing of his announcement, which came right in the middle of the first Republican presidential debate, I think it was Thursday night. That was the surprise, the timing of it, because he was expected to hold fire at least until sometime next month. But apparently, opponents of the deal began becoming concerned at the number of Democrats who were coming out in support of the president, especially after the speech he made last week, a rather aggressive speech, perhaps the most aggressive speech of his presidency in defense of this deal. And these critics may have thought by having Senator Schumer come out when he did, that they might be able to put a break on the number of Democrats who are coming out, this kind of momentum in favor of the deal. And I don't know that that was particularly successful, because yesterday another Democrat from Hawaii, Senator Brad Schatz, who's also Jewish, came out in support of the deal. That makes, by my count, at least 16 or 17 senators who've now Democrats who've now come out in favor of the deal. More are expected to come out in favor of the deal. The only question is whether or not the president is going to get the 34 Democrats in the Senate that he needs to sustain his veto there. That's the big question. If the decision to have Senator Schumer or Senator Schumer's decision to come out when he did in opposition to the deal, it has not, at least at this point, prompted any other Democrats to come out and join him in opposition to the Iran Accord. Some are expected to come out in opposition to it, but as of right now, he's the lone Democrat to come out in opposition to the in the Senate to come out in opposition to the Iran deal.
Let me go to this speech that the president gave last week, saying several things. One is that the critics of this deal were supporters of the Iraq war, kind of linking those two things, I guess, the choice between diplomacy and war. How did that play?
Well, the Republicans were none too happy about that linkage. In some ways, it may have been fair because some of the more prominent opponents of this deal were among the biggest boosters of the invasion of Iraq, an invasion that was based on the use of bogus and exaggerated intelligence. I think the president, what he was trying to do was question the credibility of these very prominent opponents of the Iran deal, the most prominent, I guess, being American former Vice President Dick Cheney, but the biggest voice against it, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Let's not forget that he testified here in Washington before the invasion of Iraq about how, you know, Iraq was harboring weapons of mass destruction, which it wasn't. And so I think he was trying to drive a hole through the credibility of some of these leading opponents, but B, I think it was also a message to Democrats who are on the fence, and he's basically saying, are you willing to be associated with the architects of this very, very unpopular war and 8-year occupation?
Another quote from this speech that he gave at American University, this was last Wednesday, and this is quoting here, just because Iranian hardliners chant death to America does not mean that's what all Iranians believe. This is the president talking. In fact, it's those hardliners who are most comfortable with the status quo. It's those hardliners chanting death to America who have been most opposed to the deal. They're making common cause with the Republican caucus. How did that play?
That really didn't go over very well with senior Republicans. The fact that he's linking the theocracy in Iraq, the hardliners within the theocracy in Iraq, and the Iranian the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps with the Republican caucus did not go over very well here. I said earlier that this was perhaps the most aggressive speech of the president's two terms in office thus far. That's a reflection, that comment is a reflection of the aggressiveness of this speech, which I believe is also reflective of the president's desire to make this deal happen and accomplish what is effectively his highest second term a foreign policy priority.
Interestingly, and this happened very recently, something like 29 American scientists praised this Iran nuclear deal. They wrote a letter to the president. How does something like that play in Washington, as this deal is being negotiated?
You know, I don't know how that particular endorsement played. Some of the people who signed that letter, for instance, the nuclear physicist Richard Garwin, are seen as being, at least by some people on the right, as being liberals, and they only expected some of these nuclear scientists to come out in favor of the deal. Interestingly enough, Dr. Garwin is a member of a group called the Jasons, and the Jasons are a independent board of experts who advise the government on nuclear weapons policy and the nuclear arsenal. So I think that was a pretty personally, I think that was a pretty significant development. This letter by these 29 scientists, but I don't think that's going to have much of an impact at all. I think, at least in terms of the criticism, I think that those who have come out against the accord, I think the president is right when he says that some of them had made their minds up even before the ink was dried on the printing out of this on the accord itself. I think a lot of opponents had made their minds up before the accord was finalized. I think there are some critics a few lawmakers who really are taking the time to really burrow down, deep dive into the impact of this. You can listen to this difference in questions when congressional committees have been holding hearings on this. You can hear, I mean, the first one that was held by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee was pretty raucous in terms of some of the criticisms that we were hearing of this accord. It was even more so than the first hearing in the House, which was pretty demure in terms of the way the questions were going. But again, I think that a lot of the critics had already made their minds up to go against this.
Do the critics offer a plan B for this nuclear deal?
Well, yeah. I mean, you hear this assertion that the United States should simply refuse, you know, that the Congress should kill the deal by passing this resolution of disapproval, preventing the United States from lifting sanctions on Iran. They claim that the United States could then use its diplomatic strength to maintain unity with the Europeans and have them maintain their sanctions on Iran. But that's kind of where this falls apart, because, first of all, I don't know that we've heard from German officials, we've heard from French officials, British officials, that they don't think there's any going back, that they don't think that the sanctions can be sustained. And certainly there's virtually no question that Russia and China will not go back to the table, will not support a resumption of negotiations. And neither, for that fact, would Iran be expected to go back to the table and accept even more sort of and be seen to be eating crow in being forced to accept additional concessions that it's not ready to make. And I think this may be one of the strongest cards in the president's hand when it comes to keeping members of Congress who've supported the deal on board the deal. The fact that there really isn't at this point, at least as far as I've heard, no realistic strategy for bringing the P5+1, that's the group of powers, international powers that have been negotiating with Iran, and Iran back to the table to negotiate a stronger deal.
Well, Jonathan Lande, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
He's a reporter for McClatchy, where he covers national security and intelligence, and the first of three guests in this hour of Radio Times as we check in with three countries about this nuclear deal or nuclear accord, the U.S., Israel, and Iran. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. And in this hour of Radio Times, three countries and three takes on the Iranian nuclear deal. Just got off the phone with Jonathan Lande. He's been covering this story for McClatchy, covering the latest negotiations in Washington, D.C. As you just heard, President Obama has been battling Republicans in Congress. Had a bit of a setback when Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, said that he would vote against this. But based on Jonathan Lande, day's mathematics, it looks like, at least as of today, that the president will be able to get his deal. Well, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made it very clear that he opposed the nuclear deal with Iran. He spoke to a joint session of Congress while it was still being negotiated to criticize the proposal. Now that there's been an agreement among the countries involved, what's the reaction and in Israel? And joining us now is Jody Radoran, and she is Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. And Jody, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
Well, we know that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been an outspoken critic of this deal. Does he reflect majority opinion in Israel?
Basically, yes. I mean, it's pretty much wall-to-wall among political leaders and also mostly among security experts. There is pretty much consensus that the deal is not a good one, that there could have been a better one. I think that's a pretty consensus opinion, and also really among the public, who find it quite frightening. Where things diverge is more on Netanyahu's tactics over the last year, 2 years, in terms of dealing with his criticism and dealing with the United States, and especially his tactics since the deal was signed and going forward. There is a growing group of people who say that it should be accepted at this point as a fait accompli, and that the focus should really be on the day after, on repairing relations with the Obama administration, and not on taking the fight kind of to the death in Congress. So there's some division on sort of tactics and strategy, but I don't hear a lot of Israeli voices saying anything other than that the deal is bad. I'll give you a caveat on that in a bit, if you like.
But. Oh, that's fine. We love caveats on this show. But let me just follow up on the tactics. And is the prime minister being criticized for going to Congress, essentially bypassing the president, but going directly to a joint session of Congress to lay out his criticisms before this deal was even signed?
Well, he was criticized quite heavily at the time, which also, you may recall, it was 2 weeks before the Israeli election, and it was perceived both as a, you know, dangerous intervention in American politics, a dangerous kind of challenge to Obama personally, but also people thought it was a very cynical move that was intended to boost his position at home, domestic politics, at the risk of the all-important relationship with the White House. I would say the criticism of that speech still comes back, but now people have moved on somewhat. They generally sort of include it in, as part of a list of things they think he's done poorly. Again, it's nobody here, very few people here, really question whether a nuclear Iran is a very serious threat to Israel. And again, there are few people who say, look, at least this deal delays by 10 or 15 years if the Iranians hold up their end of the bargain, the development of any weapon. Nobody really seems to think it will actually stop them, but they do think it puts it down the road a stretch. Some people do. Anyway, the real focus now is what's the trade-off between that threat versus what has been really the key tool in Israeli security for decades, which is the relationship with the United States. And while both the White House and Israeli leaders insist that the day-to-day cooperation continues and that there's no change in military aid and that all that stuff will continue, most thoughtful people here are quite worried that the level of this rift has begun to really eat away and potentially threaten Israel's security in the bigger picture.
And are we talking about the personal relationship between Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and President Barack Obama? Is that seen as, in a sense, the problem?
Well, you know, most people will always say, well, it's not a personal thing. I mean, everybody acknowledges that there is no love lost here, no trust, that there is a personal problem, that you have never gotten along. They really don't think similarly on virtually anything. And so that's clearly part of it. But I think there is also, look, there's a very major substantive disagreement on how the Iran question should be handled. I think most officials say, look, people can deal with having substantive disagreements between friends. But some mix of the substantive disagreement, the personal animosity, has yielded a kind of series of tactical decisions about strategy, about whether to keep the dispute in the back room or to air it publicly, those kinds of issues, and also these questions of intervention in each other's political lives that has kind of blown it up into a bigger thing. So I think there's a personal dimension and a more professional substantive dimension.
You mentioned earlier that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is still, it sounds like, being rather vocally critical of this deal, and there are calls for him to, what, pull back, keep the criticisms to himself, try to mend this relationship with the United States? Is that coming from the left, from the right, from different sources?
Well, first of all, I think it's worth saying that I would say in the last week or two, it's been a little less vocal. That's partly because there's been other things going on here. It struck me there are two different delegations of American congressmen who are here or have been here in the recent days, one Democratic and one Republican. This is very typical of the summer, organized by AIPAC. And I noticed in the statement Netanyahu put out about his meeting with the Democrats, he said the Democrats actually reported that he had told them specifically, I'm not going to tell you how to vote. And I saw the same thing from President Reuven Rivlin in a statement today after he met with the Republicans. So it's interesting to me that he's at least taking caution about the idea of direct intervention in the American political process, which is seen kind of as a red line. And I would say that after, you know, weeks in which every single day you heard Netanyahu publicly talking about Iran and about the threat, it's the volume is a bit down. I don't know that there's really that's a, you know, real thing, or if it's just a happenstance of the mix of news or what. I wouldn't be surprised if the volume goes right back up. Now, in terms of the question about who's criticizing the tactics, there's a couple different camps. One is the opposition politicians from the center and from the left, for sure, are speaking out forcefully about these tactics. And they're very careful to say, we also think the deal with Iran is problematic. But, and again, as I said before, they want to offset it with the safety net of the United States, and that they think they want to tear that to shreds at the same time. We also have seen there was a group of former intelligence and security chiefs who wrote a letter, sort of a petition, raising very similar concerns. Again, saying it's a fait accompli, let's move forward. And so that's a little bit of a different camp. Some of them are lefty types, and some of them are not. Some military generals and things like that.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Jody Rodoran. She's Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times, the second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, checking in with three countries to see how this nuclear accord is playing out in those countries. We began with the United States, talking about Israel now, and we'll be talking about Iran in about 10 minutes. If you want to join the conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you could tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Jody, would it be fair to say that Benjamin Netanyahu has really staked his political career, or many years of his political career, making sure that Iran never develops a nuclear weapon?
It has certainly been the central focus and his kind of true north politically. It's his kind of reason for being. I think writ large, he talks about his purpose in life as to protect and defend the Jewish state and the Jewish people, and he has always defined the primary threat against it as the Iranian bomb or the potential of the Iranian bomb. And he has been doing this from his first term as prime minister through his years in the opposition, and now for the last, this is now his third consecutive term as prime minister. And he has made it, you know, really it is a daily drumbeat, the focus of most speeches and the focus of many campaigns.
Well, and clearly, I mean, he was not at the table, part of the negotiators for this, but what, hoping that he could influence from the sidelines, especially influence the United States?
Well, yeah, and I mean, he claims credit, and a lot of other people do give him credit for pushing the United States and the United States to build a kind of world coalition for sanctions that most people agree brought Iran to the table. But yeah, the question of how his approach to lobbying on this issue and to speaking publicly about it may have alienated Americans and pushed Israel a bit outside the process. They were never going to be at the table. They never expected to be at the table. But during parts of these negotiations, they were intensely briefed by the Americans, and a lot of intelligence was shared. And there have been reports that in the more recent phases, that was not happening since the speech in March.
And what would have been a better deal from the perspective of Israelis?
Well, some of this has to do with technical things, and one of the main questions they have or concerns they have is the waiting period for inspecting certain sites if there's suspected violations. I mean, Israel originally really demanded that there be no enrichment allowed to Iran. That was something that the Obama administration, you know, disagreed with, and because they thought the Iranians would never agree to it. But I would say now the two main things they talk about are this inspection and the relationship between the lifting of sanctions and the implementation of the deal. The Israelis think that it's critical that there be a slower lifting of sanctions so that money doesn't flood into Iran, which brings us to kind of a really important larger point. President Obama made clear after the deal was signed that he thought of this negotiation and this deal as narrowly about the nuclear question and not about Iran's larger kind of behavior in the world, not about Iran's financing of terror activities, including like Hezbollah that threaten Israel. One of the main Israeli criticisms in recent weeks has been that this money would flood into Iran and Iran would then use it to finance terror groups that threaten it. And the Americans, to the extent that they've engaged, have talked about giving Israel new security tools to fight against those threats. That's something that Prime Minister Netanyahu reportedly will not discuss until the deal is finalized. And the Americans have increasingly called, including the American ambassador to Israel just yesterday, called publicly for him to move forward and talk about the day after. But this is it's really a framing issue. You know, for Israel, Iran is a rogue, bad actor that talks about wiping it off the map, that presents an existential threat, and that just shouldn't be rewarded for anything, because every dollar it gets, Prime Minister Netanyahu thinks that Iran will use to, you know, further his goal of annihilating Jews. That's his mindset. And President Obama and the White House, many of them, I think, also see Iran as a really bad actor. Of course, they chant death to America as well as death to Israel. But he was focused on the nuclear question, and that's a smaller project.
Let me get, looks like Kelly from Cinnaminson, New Jersey, to join our conversation. And Kelly, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I love this. I love this segment. I just wanted to ask your panel if she thinks that Chuck Schumer made his decision from political pressure through Netanyahu.
And
I'll take my call. Yeah.
Okay, Kelly, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I don't know if you know what that reference is, Jody. I was talking with Jonathan Lande about what's happening here in the U.S. and Senator Chuck Schumer, a Democrat, a really powerful Democrat in the Senate,
right,
has decided to vote against this deal.
Of course.
And you said, of course, but Kelly wants to know if you think it was based on Netanyahu asking for it. Is that the way it works?
I don't think it's that direct or straightforward. And as I said, Netanyahu went out of his way to say, I will not tell them how to vote. Chuck Schumer has his own long record on fighting against Iranian nuclear activity and concern about Iran's, you know, position of financing terror. He, of course, comes from New York and has many Jewish constituents and pro-Israel groups that are part of his state. And I know I saw some analysis last week of that it is sort of New York area and Florida area politicians who seem to be most considering voting against the deal. So I don't think it's as direct as Netanyahu saying to Chuck Schumer, hey, buddy, you know, vote my way. But I think it's all part of the same kind of political axis and political pressures.
You mentioned the kind of existential threat that many in Israel feel. Is there still, if not talk, the thought that Israel would act unilaterally if it felt a direct threat from Iran?
It's a really good question. And certainly Netanyahu and his ministers, right after the deal was signed, emphasize that they will always defend themselves and nothing is off the table. But most military experts that I have talked to say the prospect for an Israeli unilateral action, military strike, is really off the table for now. I mean, it was always seen as if Israel did strike, they would expect the United States to back them up. That would not, you can't really imagine that happening in this scenario. It'd be very difficult for Israel to take such an action kind of against the whole consensus of the world in favor of the diplomatic option. And one other problem is that if one of the other things going on with the sanctions being lifted is the revival of this idea of Russia selling these, I think they're called, forget, S-300s. It's a defensive weapon to Iran that was blocked because of the sanctions. If they have that weapon, that would make the Israeli capacity even more limited than it is. In general, the Israelis have a more limited capacity than the Americans would to strike the Iranian nuclear facilities. And so I everybody that I've ever spoken to thinks it is further back on the agenda than it was, say, in 2012 when people really thought it might happen. But you never know. You never know.
And I hate to do this at the very end of the show, or end of our segment, Jody, but I'd like to ask about the potential release of Jonathan Pollard, convicted of spying for Israel. There's talk that he would be released sometime later this year in the fall. How does that play in Israel? And I read somewhere that if he is released, he wants to live in Israel. How important is that story to people living in Israel?
Well, I think I wrote a couple of weeks ago that, you know, if there are two things Israelis basically agree on, it's that the Iranian deal is bad and that Jonathan Pollard should be released. It's again, kind of a wall-to-wall opinion here. But this release is basically a release that's happening according to American law based on a parole timetable, based on his original sentence. The Israelis do not. They mostly think it's too late. They think he should have been released earlier. And there was some resentment at the idea that publicizing this kind of automatic release around the time of this crisis over the Iran discussion was sort of a cynical play to, like, trade one for the other. They're not changing their view about Iran because Jonathan Pollard may come here.
Well, Jody Rudoran, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times, a job she's had for the last couple of years, the second of three countries that were checking in on this nuclear accord, again, beginning with the United States, talking with Jonathan Landay, Jody Rudoran telling us about how this is playing in Israel, and we have Ibrahim Mohseni waiting in the wings, and we'll be talking about how Iranians feel about this nuclear accord. Stay with us. We will be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We've been talking about the reaction to the nuclear deal with Iran in the United States and Israel. But how about in Iran itself? What's the public response? How is it playing out in that country's political system? And joining us from Tehran is Ibrahim Mohseni, research associate at the Center for International Security Studies at the University of Maryland, also a lecturer at the University of Tehran and a senior analyst at the University of Tehran Center for Public Opinion Research. And Ibrahim Mohseni, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's a pleasure, Marty.
Is this a big topic of conversation in Iran, this nuclear deal?
Well, the nuclear issue has been a topic of conversation in Iran for the past decade almost. People have been following it quite closely ever since it did become an issue. As the sanctions increased and as its effect on people's lives became more tangible, people tuned in and really wanted to follow on how the negotiations were proceeding. And what is important is that over the course, they have developed an idea of what Iran's rights are under the NPT, what kind of concessions Iran should be willing to give and what kind of concessions should be off the table.
Well, and I want to pick up on all of those. Broadly speaking, how do Iranians feel about this deal as they understand it?
That's a very good question, because when you ask them directly without much information on about whether or not they agree with the deal, whether they support it, you get overwhelming majority of Iranians saying that they do support the deal, that they are happy that a deal was reached. But then when you ask them about the details of the deal, we see that there's a lot of, I don't want to say misinformation, but people are not well informed about what the deal entails. And their assumptions about the deal is it's quite at odds with what's actually in the deal.
Is that because of the sanctions? And I should say to our listeners, you know, broadly speaking, this deal strictly limits uranium enrichment in Iran. It imposes pretty stringent inspections, and it gives Iran relief from these, not all, but some of these sanctions. Is it the sanctions part that, that people in Iran have a misunderstanding about?
It's on all of those, actually. Unfortunately, there has been very limited debate in Iran when it came to the negotiations. You know, in the U.S., we at least got the fact sheet prior to the finalization of the agreement. And there were a lot of public debate about whether what the U.S. was willing to sign on to was something that was acceptable or not. Here, that was the entire negotiations was conducted in total secrecy. Very little information about the agreements actually got into the press. And slowly, Iranians are waking to realize what the deal entails. And we have to also keep in mind that this agreement is in English. It's quite a long agreement. It's like 159 pages. And it's quite technical and quite detailed. And there has been very, there has been limited. It's coming, I have to say this, that, you know, that slowly people are becoming more informed. There is a lot of work that is being done in the universities and research centers trying to parse out the details of the deal, translate it in layman's term, and let people know what it is that Iran is signing on to. But at this stage, at this moment, what we are seeing in opinion polls is that there are massive misperceptions about what this deal actually entails.
Well, you know, I'm looking at some of the findings. You did a poll back in June, just, you know, June 2015, so not so long ago. It seemed like there was, at least then, and this is, of course, before the deal was actually signed, there was support for the deal. There's growing, as you write, opposition to nuclear weapons, but majority support for Iran to have a nuclear program. And I think for many people in this country, we sort of conflate both the weapons and the nuclear program that might be used for peaceful or energy purposes. But it seems in Iran, those are two very separate and different issues.
Indeed, indeed. For Iranians, the nuclear weapon issue, both from a national point of view and ideologically, there isn't much support for it. There is some level of support, I have to say, but it's not, we don't see majority support for a nuclear weapon program. But for a peaceful civilian nuclear program, the support for that has not changed, in fact, since 2006, when we have been polling on this issue. So when you ask them whether or not they think Iran should continue to develop its nuclear civil nuclear program, there is overwhelming support for it. And that support hasn't changed over the course of the past decade, even with increasing sanctions. There is a lot of things that people associate with the nuclear program. It's not only, not only they perceive it as a sovereign right, but they see it as a signal of Iran's scientific advancement, as a signal, as a symbol of Iran, what Iran could achieve on its own, even while being under sanctions and under international pressure. So there's a lot of symbolism, if you may, associated with this program. And that's why when people... when you ask them about the deal and what the deal entails, they bring that along with themselves, and they think that the deal is actually making that, in some aspects it is, but in some aspects it's putting a lot of constraint on Iran's nuclear program, and they are not really in tune with the kind of limitations that are going to be placed on Iran under the deal.
And how crippling have the sanctions been in Iran? How has that affected the, you know, regular citizens of that country?
Now, when you ask Iranians about the sanctions, I mean, specifically, They do say that the sanctions have been hurting. They do say that it has had a significant negative impact on Iran's economy. There are a lot of anecdotal stories. I mean, I've come across a lot of quite sad instances of how sanctions have hurt ordinary Iranians, you know, kids in the hospitals and limitations when it comes to medicine and other you know, other limitations that I don't think was meant to be part of the deal, but the eventual outcome of it was that ordinary Iranians got severely hurt. But what is interesting is that when you ask them what has made a greater impact, a negative impact on Iran's economy, has it been domestic and mismanagement of the economy or the sanctions? The mismanagement is what people say.
Almost
2-1.
Oh, that's interesting. Let me ask you, you know, assuming the sanctions get lifted or some of the sanctions get lifted, do the Iranian people then expect their quality of life to improve as a result of that?
So let me tell you about the assumptions they have about the deal and the expectations, and I think that would answer your question quite fully. So Iranians assume that the deal will lift all sanctions, not just nuclear-related. They also think that Iran will be able to continue to develop its nuclear program. They think that there would be no inspection of Iran's sensitive military and security sites, that's off the table. And they think that the U.S. that the sanctions would be lifted in parallel to Iran taking the steps it needs to be taking under the agreement. All of these are false. And then when it comes to expectations, they expect that within a year, so we are talking about not a year after the implementation period, but I think the clock of the year began back in July 14th, that within a year they expect to see tangible improvements in their lives. They expect to see significant reduction in unemployment. They expect to see significant investments in Iran. And surely better access to foreign-made goods, and particularly medicine and medical equipment. So they expect all of these to happen within less than a year. And this by itself could create a lot of vulnerability both for the deal and for President Rouhani, because within a year, people are going to look to see whether these things have happened. And by most accounts, experts' accounts, these things probably are not going to happen in that short time of a period. And that could spell difficulties both for President Rouhani and for the people's support for the deal.
Ibrahim, I'd like to, I'm curious, the President Obama last week made a bit of a parallel between Republicans in this country who oppose the deal and some of the hardliners in Israel, in Iran, chanting death to America, that they also oppose this deal, basically saying it's the hardliners in the country that don't want this deal to go through. When people chant death to America in Iran, what do they mean by that?
Oh, that's a very good question. I think what we see in the polls is that there's a lot of warm feeling, in fact, toward the American people. And there's a lot of positive feelings toward greater engagement, particularly people-to-people engagement. Mm-hmm. So you know, exchange of students, tourism, exchange of even media, journalists. So there's a lot of support for those kind of activities. But there's a lot of negative feelings toward the U.S. government and toward its policies in the region and in particularly toward Iran. You shouldn't expect people who have... I mean, when you tell people what is the primary reason why you have negative feelings toward the United States, you know, people say sanctions. United States has imposed a lot of sanctions on our country, has degraded our quality of life, has threatened our security. supported Saddam during the Iran-Iraq war, even as Saddam was using chemical weapons against Iran. So they have a whole list of grievances toward the U.S. policies toward Iran. Some of them date back to, you know, the 1953 coup, but some of them are as early as, you know, quite recently with elevated sanctions. So there is very little things that Iranian could point to as something that the U.S. government has done in the region, and in particularly toward them, that they like. So when they say death to America, they're calling for an end to those policies. So when you ask ordinary Iranians, and we have done this, in fact, when you tell them, what do you mean, those who say death to America, what do you mean by that? These are the kind of things they say. I've never heard them say that, I want to, I want to see you American people being harmed or anything. But it's mostly directed toward U.S. policies.
And what about the supreme leader in Iran? Has he weighed in on this nuclear accord?
That's a very good question. He has not. So since the Eid, the end of Ramadan prayers, which was about 3 weeks ago, he has had no public appearance. So what we are hearing, what I'm hearing from various sources, is that he wants this debate to, he doesn't want to weigh in until there's an actual debate, until people actually get to know what this deal entails, and for there to be a debate, perhaps. There's a lot of talk right now in the Congress, in Iranian Parliament, Majlis. That this deal needs to be reviewed by the Majlis before it could be adopted. So I think he has stepped back to let the debate begin. I don't expect him, particularly, I don't expect him to weigh in until there is a little bit more clarity as to where both the Iranian people and Iranian elite and policymakers stand when it comes to this deal.
A minute before we have to say goodbye to you, is it hard to do polling in Iran?
No. We haven't had much difficulty doing polls in Iran. We have been doing polls in Iran since 2006. Obviously, there are some red lines that we observe. These are not written red lines, but these are red lines that we think are sensible to observe, both, mostly to preserve the quality of the survey, because if you ask really sensitive questions or questions that are socially awkward, the kind of responses you would get would not have the same high quality. But we did one of the things we did with the previous poll, we went through the responses to see what percentage of the respondents actually provided a very sensitive response. And interestingly, about 90% of our respondents at least provided one very sensitive response that was at odds with the stated policies or the stated declarations of the state media.
Well, on that note, Ibrahim Mohseni, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
It was a pleasure, Marty.
Thank you so much. You're welcome. Thanks so much. He's been joining us from Tehran, research associate at the Center for International Security Studies at the University of Maryland and senior analyst at the University of Tehran Center for Public Opinion Research. The third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times talking about the nuclear Iranian accord. Stay with us. We'll be right back.